Hello and welcome to this episode of Canadian Turf Talks. I'm Dr. Sarah Stricker from the Guelph Turf Grass Institute, and I'm joined here by my co-host, Jason Haynes. Hi, Jason.
Hi, I'm the link superintendent at Cabot Cape Breton, and I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. Yeah. And we have on the call, actually, for the first time, we have two guests. First off, we have Jeff Mingay, who is a golf course architect. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get into the turf industry? What does it take to be a golf course architect?
Well, golf course architects usually know just enough about turf to be dangerous. I kind of like to leave it in the dirt, watch the seed drop, and then let these guys take over. But anyway, yeah, I was lucky enough to grow up down in Windsor, Ontario at Essex Golf and Country Club, which is a beautiful old 1929 established club that's got a great old golf course designed by Donald Ross, who I'm sure most people would recognize that name. So I was, I was fortunate to grow up on a great old golf course. It kind of really, I think, did a great job at teaching me, what great golf looked like, not just regular golf, but I was lucky. You know, I learned what great golf looked like. And I was also fortunate that my dad was very enthusiastic about golf. And funny enough, I still can't believe it when I look back, but in the mid 80s, my dad was into golf course architecture. And I used to go down to his office. He was in the insurance business, and he would have all these old great golf books on his shelves, history books, architecture books. And funny enough, I was into two things. I was into like punk rock and metal music. And suddenly I started reading all my dad's books, and I got into golf course architecture. It like bit me really, really young. And again, those two exposures, to have exposure to the knowledge that my dad had, and then the exposure of playing a great golf course. Since I was about 15 years old, I knew that I wanted to design and build golf courses. And then I started bothering people in the industry. How do I do this? How do I get into it? And funny enough, Jason, I now have a link because I met Rod Whitman back in the late 90s, which kind of shows how old I'm getting. And I bugged Rod. I knew he had worked for Pete Dye and had shaped his own golf courses. And everyone I had talked to had taught me that, you know, if you want to be a great architect, you need to learn how to run equipment. So I pestered Rod, and I worked on a bunch of projects with him throughout the early 2000s, including Cabot Links. That was the last project I was on with Rod. I was actually the first of us on site with Ben Cowan-Dewar to take a look at the site. And we went through a number of years trying to get it all together and then building the course. Right after we were done Cabot, I went off my own, and I principally been, this leads us back to cutting, principally been working on the rehabilitation of, you know, old historic golf courses, fixing up stuff that needs work and restoring some great old work by some great old architects. So I've been off of my own since, again, 2009. And Cutton, Bill and I have known each other for a number of years back when he was the assistant at Toronto. And when he picked up the head job at Cutton Fields, we started talking about maybe what was possible. We've probably the most gratifying project of my career so far. And we just dropped seed on the last four greens. So that's my story in a really, really small nutshell.
That's awesome. Yeah. And as you alluded to, the second guest on our podcast here is Bill Green, who is the superintendent at Cutton Fields in Guelph, Ontario. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
So what is your background, and how did you become the super at Cutton?
Well, similar to Jeff, you know, I think a lot of people's passion for golf starts with their parents, and no different. For me, my dad also was an avid golfer, and I would often begin to play and be around the game. My actual first job was caddying at Mississauga Golf and Country Club, and a bunch of my friends were members there. So that was a way that I could play with my friends, was to caddy there and make some money. And I actually kind of started taking an interest in maintaining golf, and I had made a little chip and putt in my backyard when I was 15 years old that I would practice my chipping, and I had different mowing heights for fairways and greens, and I would just kind of practice golf. So that's kind of how that all started. And then I was just, you know, went to school at University of Guelph and followed that up with a couple years at Penn State, worked at Baltusrol during my internship with Mark Coons. And that was a great experience to be down there for that. And then kind of after that, you know, I was kind of always drawn also to like building and construction. And I worked with Bert McFadden at Georgian Bay Club and was part of the initial construction and growing of that property up in Collingwood. And then was fortunate enough to get the job at Toronto. And I was there for 10 years and we did a $5.5 million renovation there in 2009, which was very extensive and gained a lot of experience with both those projects that kind of helped prepare for what we're doing at Cutting Fields or just finishing there now with Jeff. So
it's kind of an interesting thing that both of you kind of have said or things that you've done. You know, you mentioned your $5 million renovation in 2009 and Jeff, you know, working on Cabot Links during around the same time, probably. It's kind of an odd time in the golf industry to be doing, you know, big projects or spending money. I mean, how did that go? I mean, I was working on like cutting my budget in half during 2009.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as you know, I think Toronto Golf Club's a special place, and it was actually like that project. The one thing about working at Toronto Golf Club that I find is unique among other places is whenever they did any sort of project, they really took their time planning it. And it was very, very well thought out. So, I mean, that project was actually 6 years in the making. And so we had tons of time to, you know, get, you know, the club to get the funds together and all that stuff, but also for us to plan and execute. You know, this included, you know, we traveled to the architect that we had hired for that job, Martin Hawtrey, wanted us to go to England to see how they maintain heathland courses in England. So we went to Swinley Forest and Sunningdale and St. George's Hill just to see those things. And you know, that's how well planned and thought out everything was. You know, like typically when you do a renovation, as soon as it's approved, it's like, okay, let's go, let's get on it right now. And you don't even have time to think. But I think taking the time really helps execute things better.
Speaking of awkward times to have renovations, don't you think it was a bit of a challenge to have this renovation at Cutton over the COVID-19 pandemic? What made you choose to do the Cutton renovations when you did?
Well, funny enough, we were supposed to do the renovations in 2020 and we were going to have a contractor do it. We'd even had contractors submit bids and we had just kind of taken all those bids when COVID hit. And then that sort of made us reevaluate. You know, we had done 4 or 5 holes at that point on our own successfully. And then we just kind of were like, you know what, like we Jeff and Mark Hughes and myself all kind of, and Craig Moore, our general manager, all kind of felt like we think we can pull this off in-house or ourselves. And I think it really made it one of the most unique situations and jobs around in terms of, you know, the final product and what we could produce that, you know, and not that the contractor couldn't do it, but just, you know, some of the limitations that you might have with a contractor versus, you know, doing it in-house in terms of change orders and things like that. So
Well, it just made me think that there's a famous line in golf architecture. I think it was Ben Crenshaw that someone asked him, what's the most important thing in golf architecture? And he said, time. And, you know, as soon as you hear that word, you think, well, yes, of course, that's the most important thing. But no one, not many people would think of it. And what ended up happening when we were ready to go full tilt at Cutton with a contractor, you know, we were going to start Labor Day of 2020. And, you know, that fell apart pretty quick. As Bill said, early in the spring when we got bids, we knew that that wasn't going to go down. But then we decided that we had the resources in place to start chipping away. Bill was smart as the project manager to bring in a guy you just mentioned, Mark Hughes. Mark had worked for TDI, the golf course construction company, for 20 plus years, I think, you know, up to the point he started working with us at Cutton. Mark lives nearby and he was tired of traveling, and there was COVID, and suddenly Mark was freed up, a guy that can run every piece of equipment, knows how to build every golf feature imaginable. Also, he claims he doesn't, but he's been doing it so long, he actually has a great architectural eye too. It was almost stars aligned for us when you look back on it. You know, we had Bill managing the project with a bunch of turf grass experience, a bunch of prior construction growing experience. Suddenly we had, or honestly, I'm not gonna stop complimenting Mark because he's a golf course construction superstar. And then you had me, who had some ideas, and I could help a little bit here and there, digging holes if need be. And as Bill said, it was curious that once we said, okay, well, we'll build the 15th green and see what happens. And let's build the fifth green and see what happens. Let's build the fairway bunkers on number seven and see what happens. And as we started tracking along in that direction, as Bill just said, it was interesting that we all thought, you know what? We might be able to pull this off without bringing in full-blown golf course contractor turnkey situation. And all credit to the club too. Bill can talk even more about this, but I mean, the leadership at the club, everybody from Craig Moore, who Bill just mentioned, the GM, to all the board and committee members that I've dealt with, everyone has been really patient, really supportive. And again, after, you know, I've been in this business now over 20 years, and I'm telling you what, I'm not sure that this could have ever happened except in this situation, because there's too many things that lined up perfectly. And when I look at other clubs I deal with, no offense to anyone in particular, but this just couldn't happen without so many stars aligning. But I will say too, mostly because of Bill's leadership.
So is it not common for it to be done in-house?
Not on this scale. You know, we've rebuilt, it's a brand new golf course. We've rebuilt every tee, every bunker, every green, regraded fairways. We actually built two new holes in the back nine, three maybe you can consider it, but two new holes where we had to reroute the 13th and the 16th hole to resolve some safety issues. So I, you know, my background goes back to shaping. When I worked with Rod Whitman, I was running dozers, and I still do a lot of shaping, and I've done a lot of in-house work at clubs I work at, but I haven't rebuilt 18 greens, 75 bunkers, however many tees, related irrigation work, related drainage work, related tree work, related cart path work. I'm telling you, when I think back on it, you know, we just did a town hall at Cutton a few months ago. And as I was talking up there, I kind of got choked up, because I'm telling you, the team that somehow Bill put into place and Mark really helped guide is something incredibly unique. It's actually fun to kind of like throw this out there, because we don't really talk about it too much. And you know, it's amazing that we've been able to accomplish as much as we have, because as you said, Jason, there's all kinds of work that gets done in-house, but I don't think to this scale.
Right. And Cutton Fields is originally a Stanley Thompson design, right?
Well, it's a rich guy who was originally from Guelph and made a bunch of money in Chicago and the States, Arthur Cutton. He came back to Guelph, wanted to build the club. He brought Chick Evans, who was one of the best amateur golfers of the day, late 20s, early 30s, to Chicago to help him lay out the golf course. And what the history seems to suggest is that Chick Evans didn't have a lot of experience building a golf course. So at some point around 1931, Stanley Thompson was dragged into it to help them put something together. So And it's funny. And then there's a lot of evolutionary things that have happened over the years, including changes by Stanley Thompson. He actually subdivided the back nine and sold a bunch of lots that used to be on the golf course for residential home sales for profit. It's actually kind of funny. We've laughed about it before that the safety issues that we've had to resolve in the back nine are directly related to Stanley Thompson subdividing off some of the property there. And now that the homes are built, there's people living there and they have swimming pools. There's some safety issues. So it's a little bit more complicated than it being a pure Stanley Thompson design. I think Cutton's kind of evolved into its present form. And what we're doing, I feel, is part of that evolution. You know, we've done a lot of stuff that has respected the heritage. There's no doubt about that. We've preserved as much as we've been able to, and restored as much as makes sense today. But at the same time, I think a lot of the work we've done is now part of the evolution of, you know, of the golf course into its present form.
Do you have a specific interest in Stanley Thompson, or have you worked on other Stanley Thompson courses, or is there a specific design that you kind of really like as far as architecture goes?
You know, I do have a lot of respect for Stanley Thompson. I'm working on a number of Stanley Thompson projects right now. We're working at Beaconsfield in Montreal, trying to restore his stuff, Lethbridge Country Club, Cataraqui, I'm working on a restorative base plan for right now, cut fields. So, I mean, when I look back on the old architects, you know, a lot of what we admire about them is basically just their philosophy. You know, they, back in the 20s and 30s, they had the, the right pillars in mind. You know, they always tried to build first and foremost golf courses that functioned. They drained correctly. They put the greenkeeper in the best situation possible to maintain the place. Functionality in terms of playability too, right? Designing golf courses that challenge the best players adequately, but then also cater to everyone else's enjoyment. And then thirdly, which is really important to me architecturally, is, you know, building distinctive courses, you know? Like, why do we look at Jason's Cabot Links? Because it's not anything like anything else we've ever seen in Canada. That's why everybody talks about it. So Thompson did the same thing, you know, whether he was at Cut Fields or St. George's or Westmount or Capilano, you know, he's always trying to build unique courses. So when we go to older golf courses, like we're more leaning on those pillars and trying to create golf courses that fit in that box rather than worrying about how high was this bunker or that bunker. When you let those pillars guide you, you kind of end up at the right place in terms of evolving ideas to and evolving situations as golf courses move into the future.
So I visited Cutton Fields in March of 2020, right before COVID. I didn't see much grass. It was covered in snow. So Bill, you have a pretty relatively short season. So you are undertaking just the general maintenance of the golf course plus a renovation. Plus, everybody I talked to is dealing with staff shortages. So how did you do it?
When you do something like this, it does attract people. Matt and Andrew are a couple turf students that are recent graduates that joined our team and were a big part of specifically the grow-in. And honestly, like some of it was kind of just luck too, you know, like we had a couple staff members that, like this last year, we had one girl that worked on the construction crew this spring, and she had been a part of our crew when we built 13 and 16 in 2020. So she had experience and was planning to travel this summer. And so she was like, "Hey, can I come and work for 2 months?" And I was like, "Yeah, like that's perfect." And then we got another young guy who's a millwright. You know, and I don't know, like millwrights are, they're super skilled people, and he is no different. And, you know, he just, again, just wanted to kind of be around the construction and really like working outside and the changes. And, you know, one of my neighbors worked for me, and he graduated with a degree in finance, and he could have got a job last spring, you know, as an accountant somewhere or something like that. But same thing, he wanted to see the project through, and so he was on the construction crew. So we kind of like, I had two kind of staffs going. I had my, you know, the construction crew and Mark kind of, you know, ran that. And then we had our, you know, regular maintenance crew. And every once in a while, we would need some help either way and kind of pull from where we needed to. But we really tried to stick with the two teams, so to speak. And we even like our maintenance crew, like we started at 5:30 or 6 a.m. and the construction crew started at 7. So that's how separate we kept them.
Yeah, it seems that anyone who's gone through a renovation or a construction, that's like a core memory for them. That's a pivotal moment in their career. They'll never forget that. So I think you're right about it kind of builds a team and that you want to see that project through. What's the downside of doing the renovations in-house for a full 18-hole reno?
Well, like Jeff kind of alluded to, I think, you know, we kind of had the perfect scenario. And I think that would be really, really hard to replicate that, you know, and even being by the university, you know, like created, you know, we didn't have maybe the same staffing issues because we're close and there's lots of students. And, you know, when we post a job, usually we get interest right away. We're not out in the country. And then again, like Jeff also mentioned, like the support from the committees and the board and, you know, Craig Moore, like it, all of that stuff is a real perfect storm. It would be really hard to replicate what we did. And, you know, there's things that we would change, but I don't think there's anything that we would change in how we went about it or how we did it. Just more, you know, like, well, Jeff and I have been talking, like when you go through a project like this, you know, when, I don't know, I guess you kind of, I would say maybe get more bold as the project goes on. And I think that, you know, you maybe wish that you were a little more bold in the beginning, you know, like that sort of a thing. But
yeah, you do. That's a really good point. You do architecturally as you're designing and building, you start a little apprehensive. Like, what are these bunkers going to actually look like? You know, you're at the beginning, for example, you're always afraid of like building the lip on a fairway bunker too high. Especially when you're first hole, you know, members tend to, you know, if you build something really crazy and you're only working on one hole, like we were at the start of this project, you know, you'll tend to get a lot of kickback. You know, if the members come back and all 18 holes are renovated, they don't notice that the left fairway bunker on 15 is really deep because they have to think about 75 other bunkers. So as Bill said, one of the downsides is kind of just catching your groove and getting your style, you know, and I think at the beginning, partially because of COVID, we were doing not enough to catch a groove, you know, for example, building bunkers on three different holes instead of just one hole. So you could see how different things were. Like, it's just, if that makes sense, I feel like I'm not making sense, but we weren't really able to catch our stride early. So sometimes now we go back and we look at stuff that we did right at the beginning compared to some bunkers that we just built last month. And we go, man, I wish I could get back and kind of change the backside, you know, just minor little things like that. But I do think too, and Bill just sort of suggested the same, is that the buy-in we've had from the membership at Cutton is super unique, because on other projects where we've tried to drag it out, doing in-house work, the membership just gets so sick and tired of, here come the excavators and the tractors and trailers again. And, you know, they were just here and this is dragging on. And frankly, I mean, this project has drug on. It really has. And partly because of COVID, mostly, I maybe will say, but also because they've permitted us to use this process. And it honestly, like Bill said, it's incredibly unique that a membership would have given us this much latitude without much, much more complaining about the disruption. And Bill, you know better than me because you're around the club every day, but I mean, I really haven't heard much in terms of them complaining. I think most of the membership people have bought in, and you know, it's actually given us a lot of enthusiasm, because a lot of times you lose your enthusiasm working around clubs because all you hear is pitching and complaining. And that is part of the stars aligned part of this project, is that that's just another facet that just worked out incredibly well in our favor.
So you guys kept the course open for this process?
That's another great story, Jason. I got to say this before I forget. Best temporary greens in the history of golf at Cutting Fields. Okay. Not only to these guys, I had nothing to do with it. I told Bill I was going to write an article in a magazine about how good these temporary greens are. Not only did they pick great spots in the fairways where there's nice contour and some interesting things to play around, but the way they prepared them too was pretty close to the putting surface. So leading to your question about golf being in play, they also came up some incredibly creative ways to get around the golf course, whether you're playing old greens, new greens, temp greens. It was also one of the more interesting things I've seen in my career, how they facilitated golf while we were doing this.
No, you're right on there. That's for sure. You know, this year's been interesting for sure to navigate golfers through the course, but I really think the most interesting part of the whole thing was in 2020 when we built 13 and 16. As Jeff mentioned earlier, these two holes were built to, you know, they were moved because of safety along the houses. But we built these two holes among existing holes, and they were all in play while they were being built. It was unbelievable how it was all navigated, and we do tees and build behind greens, and one entire hole like was in our old dump, and everything kind of shifted right. And it was really like orchestrated, I don't know how to explain it, but it was literally like they had a full golf course while we built two holes around them. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, they played the old par five 15th green while we were literally building the new green 5 feet from the left side of the original green. It would look like, for safety, we had erected these boards. It looked like a hockey rink. So as we were building the green, we'd go back to the landing area and look down. I said, I can't even see the elevation putting surface. How are we gonna figure out if this looks any good? You know, and then we did the same thing at five. We built a new fifth green behind the existing fifth green while they played the old green. And then 16 was another new 16, was the old 12th hole, but the old 13th hole, sorry. The old 13th was a par three. So we built the new 16th green behind the 13th green. So we continually had all these obstacles in the way, as Bill just said, while people were playing the old greens. Somebody should have made a film. It would have been a lot easier to explain.
But I think the fact that you were able to keep the course open and promise your members that you're not going to lose your course is a big part of that buy-in. But I think the other part is communication. And I think, like you've mentioned before, you did town halls, you've done walkthroughs, you've done constant updates. I think, Bill, I've seen you with your little drone, you know, those kinds of things I think really helped with that membership buy-in. They feel that it's, you know, they're part of the project and they're proud of it too. I know that many members are really excited to have their course back this year, at the end of this year. But I'm sure that they're going to want to show it off as well because they feel that they supported it, right?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You know, and from my perspective too, I think this is important as well. I can't stand it when I work on projects where the architect is kind of, I always compare it to the Wizard of Oz. Like, if the membership doesn't see what the architect looks like, what he sounds like, what he's talking about, they think you're some guy behind a curtain somewhere that they don't know who's coming to wreck your course and spend all your money. And as far as communication goes, I do feel like we did a really good job with that. Is that I love it when I go to cut and I'm flattered where I walk in and there's, as soon as I get up to the pro shop, 10 people know who I am. They come up, they either ask me a question, but why is that bunker short left of number, you know, whatever. Or, you know, oh man, we really love the new green on 8, or, you know, whatever it is. And Bill's always out front. Mark's always out front. Craig's always out front. And I've really enjoyed being out front at Cutton. And I think a lot of people know me, and there's a personal element to it rather than just somebody coming in from New York City to ruin your course in Guelph, you know? So I think that personal element that we've developed between our whole team, and then on top of that, with the club managers and the membership, that's been a really, really helpful too. Really helpful.
Yeah, I mean, we just talked about, or you just explained kind of how you juggled all of this, you know, keeping the course in play, doing the design. Did this kind of juggling, do you think it helped the design or hurt the design? Because I know, I mean, I listen to a lot of golf architecture podcasts, you know, like the shirt I'm wearing right now, Bob Ross, Happy Accidents. What do you think, Jeff? Like, how does that inconvenience versus just building up with a clean slate, how does that impact your design?
I'm glad you brought this up because Bill's sick of me telling this story, but it's my favorite story about this project. So, as I said, Bill and I had known each other for a number of years. He takes on the role at Cutting Fields, and I'm thinking, well, maybe they'll do something. Bill and I know each other, you know, so we start talking about what we're going to do. They go through an RFP process. I end up getting the gig. I start working on my plan, and as Sarah said earlier, you know, oh, this is Stanley Thompson golf course. Thompson loves sand, you know, and he loves funky looking bunkers. And, you know, so I submit my first plan to Bill, first draft, and Bill's never been shy with me, which has also led to great success on this project. That's a whole other topic, but superintendents should never be afraid to express their opinion to a golf course architect. It always works out in the favor of the end product because it's always like, that doesn't need to be that steep. That doesn't need to be, you know. Anyhow, another story. So I give my first draft of the plan to Bill, and right away, after not looking at it for too long, he says, you got this totally wrong. I was kind of offended. Well, what are you talking about? He said, this plan's got small greens and big bunkers. I need small bunkers and big greens. And at first I thought, what are you talking about? You know, but we were rebuilding the greens for agronomic reasons. And the last thing Bill wanted to do was spend X number of dollars, a lot of money, on building greens that didn't have adequate pins, that didn't drain, surface drain at least three directions, that were void of any traffic pinch points, all those kinds of things. And really, I credit the success of, I think one of the reasons this project is going to be successful is that everything we've ended up building, Bill is happy with. Because he's evaluated my design ideas, he's evaluated Mark's shaping, and anytime something was too small or too steep or there was a traffic pinch point, et cetera, you know, we resolved it. Our threesome is perfect because I've got these crazy architectural ideas. Mark knows how to build it and Bill knows how to maintain it. And I always say too, I cannot stand it when the architect's name is up in lights. And this is a perfect project to show how important that is, not to make the architect at the end of the day the be all end all. It needs to be run through, you know, here's my idea. Here's how we need to build it. Can we build it? Yeah, we can, but we need to, you know, tweak it here or there. Okay. Can we maintain it? Well, yeah, we can maintain it, but we got to do this. So it really, I guess, Bill, we've never really said it this way, but the vetting process of everything we did through the three of us was something really that I haven't experienced like in this way before. And I guarantee you, I will take this to every project moving forward. And I really, again, feel like because of that, we could go around and nitpick this. Now we should see more sand here or whatever. I think at the end of the day, this golf course is going to function the way that we want it to function. It's going to drain. It's going to be maintainable in an efficient, economical way. It's going to be playable for golfers of all abilities, all those things that I said. And at the end of the day, hopefully it's a unique, distinct place that people talk about too. But that vetting process was just an incredible experience for me. And it's partly too, because Mark and Bill aren't afraid to say to me like, oh yeah, you think you travel the world studying courses? Well, how are we going to mold this? You know, it's really important stuff.
Well, and I like that what you said, like making choices that are going to make the course sustainable in the future, right? So yes. I know one of the big changes that you made with the greens is you changed from annual bluegrass to creeping bend grass. But what other changes did you make to the course that perhaps will make management more sustainable in the future? You know, maybe uses less water or maybe uses less pesticides, or what kind of IPM architectural changes did you make?
I'll take it back here. So we did have annual bluegrass and bentgrass before. our green, our green size was about, written down here, 4,800 square feet before. The new green average is 7,200. So it's like a 50% increase in size.
And my original plan, for the record, was probably, I was averaging about 6,000 square feet, maybe.
Yeah. And I think, you know, a lot of this project was kind of like, the reason why we did it was because of winter injury. You know, we were having problems with ice in the winter and having Poa die, and it was a continual problem. And so, you know, when I first got to cutting, you know, one of the first things we did was a green site evaluation. So you went through and you rated all the green sites, and you're looking at, you know, air movement and light and surface drainage and internal drainage and entry and exit points and green sizes and pinnable areas, all that thing. It's quite comprehensive, you know. And so when we started to, you know, talk about new greens, I was like, okay, well, you know, if we're going to build new greens, like in 30 years, when the next superintendent comes in and does a green site evaluation, I want him to be, you know, set up for success, you know, down the road. So, you know, and then in conversations with Jeff, like, you know, we really pushed each other to, you know, maybe be more artsy for me. And we did some really cool things on some of the slopes on the greens. And, but at the same time, me pushing Jeff, okay, this is a shaded site. I want it bigger. It needs to be bigger. We need more space if it's going to be a bad growing environment because of sun or, but all of the growing environments on every single green was really looked at. And we really, I had this kind of green site evaluation in the back of my head thinking, okay, like we need to have good entry and exit points. Cause before at Cutton, there was a lot of points of entry where it was every golfer, whether you're in a cart or walking, was on the front right and off the front right to the next tee. And so we've taken a lot of cart paths around the backs of greens and just little things like that I think, as you said, Sarah, will create, you know, a better environment for us to grow bent grass successfully, and keep Poa out. You know, I think, you know, part of the problem is when we build really small greens with high traffic, you know, that's when you're going to start to get more Poa. And, you know, I'm not naive enough to say that we'll never have Poa and never deal with it. But I think that the, you know, having going through this list of green site evaluations and pinnable areas, will set the greens up for success for a long time is the hope. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I remember you changed the orientation of one of your greens to be more facing towards the sun. And I know you removed some trees and those kinds of things, and just continually explaining back to the members that these things will make it better for the future, right? And for your growing, you know, treating turf as an actual living organism as opposed to an ornamental one, right? It's not just carpet that I put down because it looks nice. It actually needs these things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think agronomically, we had three greens that had some sunlight issues that we can't really do anything about. So, you know, I suggested to Jeff on those three greens, you know, I want them bigger, just so we can spread wear out a little bit better. But the other thing is, you know, if we could get them facing south, like, as you said, Sarah, so we had three greens that we really wanted to have facing south to maximize sunlight. You know, it's like a solar panel, right? Like, you don't put solar panels facing north, you put solar panels facing south, and they do that for a reason. And so, you know, so then some of these areas, Jeff can talk about it, but were very, very challenging for him to, and Mark to kind of figure out. But you know, we went back and forth for months sometimes it was pretty intense trying to figure it out, but I think they all worked out really well.
There were two of those three green sites that he wanted pitched to the south that Mark and I, after 20 years of building golf courses and greens, we said, these greens cannot pitch to the south. You cannot build them like this. Bill wouldn't stop. Yeah, there's got to be a way you could do it. You know? And then again, over months, Mark and I was like, you know what? We're going to show them that we can figure out a way to build these things and tip them south. And 8 was one of them that is now maybe my favorite green. It's not in play yet, so we'll see how it performs. But it worked out really cool, only because of Bill's encouragement to get us to tip it south, which I swear I never would have done. And I know Mark Hughes never would have done either. Like, just the site where the surface water wanted to go, et cetera, et cetera. We never would have pitched this green the way that we pitched it. And now that we did it, I'm thinking, wow, you know, I never would have thought of that. This turned out pretty cool. The other challenging one was number 4, which was a tough growing environment. Well, Bill said, we need a huge green in here. But the problem with Bill's idea of a huge green is he thinks if we build a huge green, it all should be pinnable too. So as an architect, how do you build a huge green that's just a big old pinnable green? So it took a lot for us to try to figure out, okay, well, if we're going to dump water off 3 sides. And it's funny, we were talking about it today, actually. Some of the best greens I've built recently, you know, are simply designed for function. Like, if you take a big enough green and you drain it in 3 directions, you've got some troughs and some ridges and some things that are already existing. And all you've done is done things to surface drain it. And then you add a couple little, you know, rolls here, a roll there to break up a bigger area or whatnot. And, you know, it's funny how I think when people overcomplicate building putting surfaces, that's when they're weird and hard to maintain and don't drain right. And I think if a lot of times you lean on functionality and then just put a couple little nuances in it, they're some of the best greens you'll ever see.
It's kind of interesting. I mean, as I'm learning, you know, at Cabot here, just how much of that functionality plays into it. You know, when I used to hear about, you know, like 9,000 square foot greens, or you know, we have a 30,000 square foot putting green, I kind of would roll my eyes. Oh my God, the cost of that. But actually, you know, what I've learned pretty quickly here is the type of grass, the size of the putting green, there's like a point where you hit the perfect size to type of grass and to cost. And like, I've never had bigger putting greens. So I have over 200,000 square feet and I've never spent less on their maintenance. And that's even with 9 holes with 35,000 square foot of POA putting greens, 200,000 square feet of fescue costs less, but it has to be 200,000 square feet for fescue. So it's big. and same thing with bent grass. I think, if you want it to make it work, you have to spread that traffic a little more than you would with, say, POA.
Just like all of Rod Whitman's golf courses, like Cabot, I was so fortunate to be involved with it, but like, he contours a golf course better than anyone else. But as you know now, Jason, most of that contouring is surface drainage. It starts with, where do you want to get the water off? And then when you think about greens, as I just said, it's the same way. And it's amazing where function will lead you. Stop trying to be the most creative guy in the world. And, oh, look, I could build a shelf back here and a hump here and this here and that there. And, you know, just think about it in simple terms. You know, what would the ground look like if this was just water running over it? You know, and you do that and all of a sudden you're like, wow, that's pretty cool green.
Yeah, exactly. And like, we on Friday, so it's now Monday. On Friday, we had 2 inches of rain. As I speak right now, there's thunder and lightning rolling through. We've had over an inch of rain in the last hour. Now, tomorrow, I'm probably going to be pumping water, but it's not going to be off the putting greens. It's going to be just a few bunkers, a couple of the low spots. But for the most part, there's no standing water on this like massive golf course. And the greens will be, I mean, even during the rainstorm, will be fully playable.
That's great golf architecture right there, period. I don't want to talk about how long this hole is, what's it, par, and that's great golf architecture right there. Taking all that water off that property is amazing.
Everybody always talks about a golf architecture from like the golfing standpoint, which, well, I mean, I've never had more fun playing golf than on Cabot Links. Like, I didn't get it until I played it. And then I was like, this is, I can't really explain it. I don't have the words for it, but it was the most fun. But then as a greenskeeper with good architecture, like, it's a minimalist design, but it's also minimalist maintenance. Like, I don't want to, it has its challenges, but it's way easier than I thought it would be, because the design lends itself to be maintained. So it's pretty cool to kind of hear how you're doing that at Cutton, and then now for me to have that experience.
Yeah. I mean, if I always say, if he can't build, and people like you, Jason, can't present what we built properly, it's going to reflect poorly on both of us. And that's why the golf architect and the superintendent have to be on the same level, same wavelength and same level. It's not like the architect comes into the project and say, okay, here's what we're going to do. Here's the bunker liner you're going to use. Here's the sand you're going to use. Here's what you're going to do here. Here's what you're going to do. That's ridiculous. You know, you work as a team. And I think that, again, Bill and Mark as well, you know, the three of us have, it's just been, again, stars aligned, and the vetting process and all of the input the three of us have put into it has just been something unique to my experience. And I can't wait to see how this place actually plays when we're able to go first tee to 18 green.
Yeah, I think you're opening in October, right? And so Cutton Fields is established in 1931, so it's 92 years old. So what's the plan for the next 10 years, 30 years, 90 years? Is the game of golf going to change? I know that we're seeing increases in length and distance. Cutton is surrounded on all sides. Well, one side by a river and the other three sides by houses and the university, right? There's nowhere else you can go. So what is the plan to adapt to the golf as it changes?
I mean, we just added over 400 yards. So I think that, you know, as technology changes, that will continue to impact the golf course, unfortunately. I mean, for the next 10 years, you know, there's some minor little changes that you know, Jeff and I have discussed, you know, creeks and other little things that we need to kind of clean up and fix. But you know, for the most part, it's just going to be hopefully enjoyed by the members and their guests. And you know, we plan on having a couple national events, you know, like we had a women's amateur in 2017. And so, you know, we've already been in some talks about bringing that back maybe for the 100th anniversary. You know, but I think in general, like our... For me in the future, I think, you know, Jason kind of alluded to this, but staffing is a challenge, and just costs of golf, you know. And I think I listened to Jason speak at Cutton Fields. That's why he was there in March in 2020, and I saw him speak there, and I think we're on the same page, and Jeff too. Like, we value the kind of minimalist approach to golf. And I think, you know, I think some people, golfers initially are not supportive of that approach. But, you know, I think ultimately, like, we want to cut costs down of maintenance, you know, and make it easier. And I really like that sort of European style of maintenance and just, you know, not having lots of gardens and ball washers and cart paths and all that kind of stuff, you know, it's just carts add to the cost of the game and make it really expensive. Yeah, Jeff and I have often talked about, you know, if I could build a course today, I would have three mowing heights. That's it. I'd have my green, I'd have my long fescue, and then everything else would be the same height. Like, for not one fairway and rough would be one.
Kind of Cabot Links-ish, right, Jason?
Kind of, it sounds exactly like Cabot Links or the Cliffs, I think, has two heights of cut. It's fairway and green.
I think it would be really cool.
But see, no one does that in Ontario or anywhere else other than Cabot. It is.
I don't think that's for cutting necessarily, at least not right now. I think in Ontario, I think it'd be interesting to build something like Cabot in that way of like a two or three height golf course. And, you know, Jeff and I have talked about, you know, really defining the fairways by the bunkering and, you know, that kind of thing. But yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. Well, and with the set heights too, autonomous mowers can handle that kind of thing pretty easily, right? So just set it and forget it, right?
Well, it'd be interesting to talk to you, Jason, about, I'm imagining if a set like the setup like you have, you kind of need less stuff, less equipment, you know, maybe like if you have a fairway mower, it's a little busier. Maybe you have more than normal, but you don't have two rough cutters, or you don't have a collar mower, or you don't have a tee mower. Like it's all just one thing, you know what I mean? And which would save space in your maintenance area. You know, there's all these things that I think would filter down.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've always, you know, within my control as a greenskeeper, found ways to kind of make things cost less without impacting the conditions, of course. And now with my experience on good golf architecture, I think that in hindsight, I wish I would have pushed harder on that, because I've seen now firsthand just how big of an impact good architecture has. Having better traffic flow is so huge. I thought, like, I mean, traffic management's still pretty big for fescue, but like, I have one traffic stake on like in just a massive golf course. Now I have almost no golf carts, but we're putting through a lot of rounds, and just the design of the course lends itself to be easy to maintain with lots of people golfing it. So it's pretty cool. And something that I think, like Bill, you're going to realize here in the next few years, and hopefully more people kind of get on board, because it really has, if done properly, I mean, I've seen architecture cost a lot of money, but if done properly, I think it can really increase the value of the game and make it more fun, but also reduce that cost. And so yeah, I think it's pretty cool.
You know, and again, Jason, I can't stress it enough. Like, that's again why I think superintendents have to be so involved with the architectural process and the construction process. It's frustrating to me how many courses I've visited over the years where the superintendent, even in some cases, the superintendent was there when they were either remodeling or building the golf course, says to me on a tour, "I can't believe they left me with this. Left me with 200,000 square feet of bunkers. They left me with this. Look at these traffic pinch points. I can't mow these steep slopes in the green, et cetera, et cetera." You know, I'm thinking to myself, did nobody, like, why weren't you having these conversations in the process of the construction and the renovation? And I don't mean to criticize those people. I just mean, I think it's an important point moving forward. If there's turf students and superintendents listening to this, and even architects, I mean, you got to work as a team, because if Bill can't present what I have in my mind properly, we're both going to look bad. I mean, it's a very, very simple equation. And again, I think this project speaks volumes to that. And I think it will over the coming years.
Yeah. Well, it depends on the personality of the person too. Sometimes it can be really hard to speak up against someone who you've hired to bring in, and you're going to turn around and say, "Oh, I don't like that." So
Well, that clearly means that Bill's not afraid of me, which I don't know, could be good or bad. That's interesting. I think I would give the same advice that I got, to be quite honest with you. Like, I don't know why I was such a dork at the time, but, you know, I was writing letters to guys like Tom Doak and Gil Hance, and in the late 90s, before anyone even knew who those guys were. I just knew they were young guys who were writing on architecture, doing stuff. You know, and they all told me the same thing. You know, if you want to be a great, great architect, you got to know how to build. You know, you can't just say, you can't come up with just kind of what I was saying in terms of the superintendent architect relationship. And you have to know how to build things that are going to work. And I don't really think, and I've learned it now, but these guys advised me of that right out of the gate. You got to go learn how to run dozers and excavators and know how to build this stuff. Then you'll, you know, then you can design and actually know how that's implemented. Hugely important. Secondly, I would say that if you really want to be great at this, you better not be a fan of being home and hanging out with your friends and seeing your family or making a steady income. And it's true because, you know, I'm 20 years into this now. I've had massive lulls where there's not a lot of work going on, whether it's economy or pandemics or whatever it might be. Steady income is tough until you really get a groove. And then again, to go do the work, you're not leaving home at, you know, you're not doing a 9-to-5 where you're coming home for dinner. You know, I've been all over this continent to Europe, to Brazil, you know, chasing what I want to do. So I've seen a lot of really, really smart guys come in, guys who I really liked, and they couldn't handle the lifestyle. It's just a nutty lifestyle. It really is. If you really want to be good, I mean, you might luck out and find an architect who will put you to a 9-to-5 sitting drawing CAD plans, but that's also not fun architecture. You kind of have to be ready to live the vanguard lifestyle and make sure you got a line of credit.
You're like the Indiana Jones of golf. You're going all over the world, all strange adventures.
That's what it is, man. All my heroes in the business have been on strange adventures and had money, not had money. I mean, that goes back to Stanley Thompson and Alistair McKenzie. It's just kind of a volatile industry. And I don't, volatile sounds bad. It's not bad, but it is a bit volatile. You know, you just don't really know what's good. We're on a roll right now where there's a lot of work going on and most of the people I know in the industry are doing great. But I remember when we broke into Cabot Links in 2009 and we got the phone call October that year and said, I think everybody should go home. Maybe you might want to return the equipment. And then we spent that whole winter wondering whether or not the place was even going to be built. And I was going, okay, well, should I apply at the convenience store down the road? Because we might not be build any golf courses anytime soon. So that's what happens. You know, right now we're in a really great place, but there's always huge ups and downs in terms of work. So that's a huge warning to anyone who's interested. I don't think most people understand exactly what the lifestyle entails. But once you get into it and you love it, it's hard to get out of it too. So that's me.
The beaches are pretty nice, but yeah, that would have been something else. So Bill, what advice would you give someone looking to renovate their golf course?
As I said before, like my experience at Toronto, I think executing a good plan and really, really take your time and communicate it really well with your membership. And, you know, like 6 years was a long time and maybe a bit long, but, you know, the end result is undeniable. And, you know, that's kind of what happened here too. Like our vote to do this project was done in 2019 and now it's, you know, 2023. So we had lots of time to talk with Jeff and Mark and I to talk out the details of how we were going to build and construct things. And, you know, I've seen a few projects in the past where, you know, there's some, you know, reactionary decision made at a club, and something gets pushed through really quickly on a club or on a superintendent, and it makes it really, really hard to be on budget and successful and all that. Like we've done really well with our budget, so I think just taking the time and good planning is the key.
That's awesome. Well, thank you both for joining us on this episode of Canadian Turf Talks. I hope everybody learned something. I know I did. Is there anything, any final remarks you want to say before we end the episode?
Well, I just want to thank Jeff and Mark Hughes, who isn't here, and the rest of my staff that went through the last couple years with us here. It's been quite a ride. I'm looking forward to, you know, my biggest decision of the day, whether we you know, cut or roll, you know, that kind of a thing. So I'm looking forward to those days.
And see, I did the exact opposite today. I'm walking around the golf course figuring out how we don't stop working because I'm having too much fun and I don't want to go. I'm picking out new bunkers and tees to do, and you know, maybe we should start over and just start fixing everything up again. But yeah, it really has. It's been again, it sounds kind of cheesy, but it really has been a stars aligned situation. And you know, I was thinking earlier, somebody said something that reminded me of the you know, live and learn, right? And I think I've become a better architect because of this project, because of the input I've gotten from Bill on the agronomic side. And even Bill likes architecture too, so I get some architecture challenges from him as well. And Mark on the building side, just coming up with ideas and having these guys challenge me on the building side and on the agronomy side and on the architecture side, I learned a tremendous amount that I know that is going to take me forward, you know, much more successfully than otherwise. And I'll forever be grateful for that, honestly. And I think everybody, superintendents and architects, should try to get that out of every project you work on. I mean, seriously, what else could you ask for, right? An architect flying in going, hey, I got all the ideas, let's do this, and then just running out of town. I mean, that's no fun, and that's not going to be lead to the most successful product. So again, and I think there's always a shaper there, there's always a superintendent, there's always an architect there. You know, people should, honestly, I'm lucky to have had the relationship I had with Bill and Mark, but people should strive to have the same. Don't put yourself on any level, architect, shaper, superintendent, wherever you might take it. I mean, it's a team effort. And the history of golf architects speaks to that. I mean, even Cabot Links, Jason. I mean, there's so many guys and so many people out there. I mean, it's Rod led the charge, but boy, did so many people, including yourself now, put so much into where the course came from and what it's evolved into. And, you know, there's no architect that's ever lived who's responsible for anything. And again, this is a real eye-opener project for me and a real great learning experience. So.
That's awesome. I love it. Well, thank you to our audience for tuning in to this episode of Canadian Turf Talks, and we'll hope to see you around for next episode. Have a great day. This podcast is brought to you by the University of Guelph and the Guelph Turfgrass Institute.